Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth. The following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
Bring someone you want to excite to see Score. An invitation to a completely different kind of motion picture. An invitation to a wild and wicked weekend of mixed doubles. Experience the possibilities with...
The other day, Jack decided he wanted to answer one of those ads. You know.
Are we playing Loretta Young this morning?
When did you do that?
One night at bowling. You know that night. You were having your period. You weren't feeling well.
The 6 months are nearly up. You're running out of time.
I haven't lost this one yet.
An invitation to watch or play as everyone tries to...
Can I get you a cup of coffee before I go?
No, thanks. Maybe later.
Elvira speaks very highly of you.
The perfect marriage.
Amyl nitrite. What's it for?
Hey, it's a nice looking ring. Do you like it? I wasn't sure I liked it. I thought it looked a little queer. Queer strange or queer faggoty?
Sometimes it can make an evening more interesting.
You don't suppose they'll want to stay the whole weekend?
We've got to get out of here.
There's a first time for everything.
Eddie's not very good at it.
You and Betsy been married long?
About a year.
I think marriage is a no-no.
Elvira and I have been married a lot longer.
Why don't you take off your hat and stay away?
I tell you all about it, only you'd blush.
Don't you want to cover up?
Perfect marriage.
With all of you in the bed, how do you know?
Who's who?
Well, yeah.
An invitation to bring someone you want to excite to a completely different kind of motion picture. Radley Metzger's Score.
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me this week is Lisa Vandiver of the CineKink Film Festival.
Hi, Mike. It's very lovely to be here.
Great to have you. This week, we're looking at Radley Metzger's groundbreaking 1974 film, Score, based on a play of the same name by Jerry Douglas. Score is the tale of two couples, a secular set of sex enthusiasts, and a rather naive pair of newlyweds. Throw in a telephone repairman, some sultry songs, and poppers, and you've got yourself a party. Lisa, we've been talking about doing an episode of the show for a few months now, and I really threw the door wide open to you. So of all the films that could be considered erotic or pornographic, you chose Score. What does this movie hold for you?
The thing I've noticed over the years in curating CineKink is how rarely explicit depictions of sexuality and strong narrative storytelling go hand in hand. I think Radley Metzger's work in general, and Score specifically, really are a great example of that. This sort of becomes gold standard for me in what I look at an erotic film to accomplish. You have an engaging and compelling situation at the heart of it, attractive but real-seeming performers, as opposed to what you might see in much of today's porn, believable performances, visually satisfying sets, solid production techniques. And the really important thing for me is that the sex enhances the story rather than takes us out of it.
Yeah, at first I was a little nervous with, like, the telephone repairman showing up, where it was like, you know...
Right. Boom, chakala. Right.
The pizza boy of his day kind of thing. Did anyone order a 10-inch sausage? Yeah.
Telephone company.
I wasn't expecting you so soon.
What have we got here?
We had a little party last night. We were all drinking rather heavily. Someone must have stumbled over the cord.
Under the table? What were they doing under the table?
I can't imagine. Can you?
Must have been some party.
Average.
What do you do at a good one? Knock out a wall?
Depends on the guest list.
I wish I'd been invited.
If I'd known you yesterday, you would have been. You must excuse me, I wasn't expecting anyone.
Yeah, that's all right. I tell you, in this line of work, you see people in all states, you know what I mean?
Well, if you'll excuse me, My friend is here. We were just going over some things upstairs.
Recipe.
Something like that.
So, I mean, there are definitely elements of that, and it's certainly, you know, it's shot in, what, 72? So you have the camp elements of it being from the 70s. But once you kind of get past that, it just really pulls you in as a story itself, as a movie, and then, you know, by the time you're into much of the sex, you're so sort of enmeshed in what's going on that you really don't notice it, per se. I think Radley even talks about that, the latest DVD release of it. He says sex becomes like any other dialogue, and it's interesting. He really credits the script supervisor that they worked with, and he also had a background as an editor, so there's that concern with continuity. You're not letting anything in that pulls you away from the story.
Yeah, what I really liked about the film was just the way that it progressed and the way that the seduction kind of goes along. So for listeners at home, you know, so much of this movie is the Elvira character trying to get Betsy into bed, and then also Elvira's husband trying to get Betsy's husband into bed as well, and just how that progresses throughout the film, and just all of Elvira's different attempts to, you know, what was it, Operation Music Box that she's performing, you know, and trying to, using the camera, as far as her husband's a photographer and using one of his cameras, and then having the telephone repairman show up and all these kind of things, and then using the marijuana later on, and that whole party scene, which, I don't know about you, but for me, it reminded me of like a really nice version of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, you know, where you've got these two couples, and rather than fighting all the time, they're f***ing instead.
And there's such a playful element to the scheming, and it's like, darn you, I'm going to beat you, and I'm going to win this competition. And in a way, it kind of reminds me more of like a kinky version of Heart to Heart, where they're sort of like in this game. And in fact, if anyone ever wants to back it, I would love to see that happen. A kinky version of Heart to Heart, where maybe every week they try to take on a different swinging couple, and we see them. That would be my movie.
This is my boss, Jonathan Hart, a self-made millionaire. He's quite a guy. This is Mrs. H. She's gorgeous. She's one lady who knows how to take care of herself. By the way, my name is Max. I take care of both of them, which ain't easy. Because when they met, it was murder.
But yeah, so it's just a really fun story. And, you know, historically, this kind of came up for me was last year we had a really great feature that came through from new director Vivian Darkbloom. It won our Audience Choice Award for narrative feature called In Dietro. I kept referring to it as this looks like a Radley Metzger, and people weren't quite getting the reference. So, yeah, I think it's really important to, as we study film and study our film history, know where we came from and what happened before.
Yeah, and I want to thank you for sending me In Dietro, and I could totally see while I was watching it, I was like, oh yeah, I can really, I mean, just the couple dynamics, plus you've got the one extra character that's there, but I really like the fractured time line of In Dietro too. That was really nice. Yeah, kind of going backwards through the evening to see how things worked, and it was very, very clever.
You don't believe in God, do you?
Hi, we're here to see you.
They're expecting you.
Perhaps we should have the help do a bit of spot cleaning.
Sir.
It's not your husband that's making you miserable like that. Home you built together, it's your lack of faith. Your lack of polarizing focus. You need something to worship.
I
Me.
So it's a different take on the narrative, but the same thing that came up for me was just sort of the sumptuous visuals, but also that you're so caught up in the story that the sex isn't pulling you out. Much of the stuff that comes through that I'm trying to put into the festival is like there's a brief setup of the story, and then you go into maybe 20 minutes of cunnilingus, which is just like, okay. So for me, the desire for a narrative is stronger than watching somebody go at it for 20 minutes necessarily.
I liked that there were, you know, there's the brief introduction of the characters at the beginning, Elvira and her husband having a little romp, like, and then you get the, what is it, about 20 minutes in, you get the telephone repairman, Mike, with Elvira as well, which looks like it could lead into a threesome, but no.
Not quite.
Just the way that everything just keeps building and building and building until mm-hmm. you get the, like, the double, I won't say double penetration, but the double sex scene, you know, and the way that it's cut from one couple to the other, I think is just so clever. And that's something that I don't see. I used to see it a lot in porn, was having multiple sex scenes going on at once that were being intercut, which made it so much more visually interesting and narratively interesting. And it just seems to have gotten away from that so much.
Well, and it's also because so many porns are shot like in a couple of days, whereas this is like a 6-week shooting schedule. But watching the scene you referenced with the telephone repairman and Elvira and Bessie was just sort of the eye line things going on, you know, had them on the bed and Bessie's kind of watching intrigued. And so to be able to build that with the different angles and really taking his time and shooting it, that's so much of it there. But it just, production and technique-wise, it's just an amazing thing.
And I was talking to someone just the other day, and we're talking about the differences between acting in films these days versus what it used to be. And she had said something like, the women in porn films today don't tend to be actresses. They tend to be sexual stuntmen. And,
right.
And you don't get that with, I mean, Claire Wilbur mm-hmm. as Elvira and Lynn Lowry as Betsy. I mean, they are so strong in their performances. And it doesn't hurt that both of them, to me, are knockouts and in very different ways. You know, Lynn Lowry's, right. She's very interesting looking, let's say, kind of elfin mm-hmm. and everything. And then Claire Wilbur looks like she stepped right out of Beyond the Valley, the Dolls, you know?
Right. The men, too, are very attractive. I will jump in with that. And not in a way that's necessarily intimidating to the male viewer, but it's somebody I could see being attracted to in real life. Much of the porn physique these days is not necessarily that. So.
And they seem to be having fun, especially the guys. They seem to be really having a lot of fun on screen, just like their whole banter when they're getting dressed up, you know, and that whole, mm-hmm. like, best one I've ever had, old friend, you know?
Well, and I think they were having fun, and it was very interesting to look at this version, the uncensored version, because I had seen it before without the actual gay sex in it, and it's some pretty hot sex. In the censored version, you know that they go back together, but you don't have the whole, you don't see them fucking, as it were.
It's not hardcore. You know, you don't see the actual penetration and everything. I think that that is, I know it sounds silly, but it's even hotter that way. Because
mm-hmm.
it's
yeah.
not so, sometimes these films, it's just like, you know, mm-hmm. we're going to get right into every crevice and stuff. It's just like, no,
right.
step back a little bit, you know.
They don't need to see all those flaws.
Exactly.
With some of the close-ups, like a little too close. I don't know if that just goes along with the extreme stunts that you have with a lot of porn, but it's just, we're just going to get right in there and we're really going to show it to you. Whereas for me, it is much sexier when you either have it implied or you see it, but you're not necessarily seeing it, as I said, for 20 minutes and close up. It's almost for me like when you film somebody eating a meal, because you might not want to see every single action that goes on, but you have enough there to know that they're eating a meal and to be caught up in it.
I always hear the stories about, oh, Deep Throat was the first film where couples would go and it wasn't shameful to go into these theaters and see these films and blah, blah, blah. And I would much rather have gone, maybe I'd go see Deep Throat as a one-off kind of thing just to see what people were talking about. But for me, I would much rather go see something like Score where I can get invested. And also, and this is no offense to the cast of Deep Throat, but they weren't very attractive people. And I look at something like Score, and it's like, these are beautiful people, beautiful location. For me, the humor was there. You know, Deep Throat is just like groaners.
The humor's there, but...
Vaudeville kind of humor, where I was looking, yeah, for something a little bit more highbrow. And watching Score, it's like, I want to go to the Dalmatian coast, like right now. The location is beautiful on this film. And I think the performances really weren't theatrical performances, because so many times you get this kind of like, I don't know, labored, very stilted dialogue kind of thing. And I have to hand it to Claire Wilbur as Elvira. She was the only person from the stage version to make it into the film version. And her performance is terrific. You know, she's not doing that kind of, I don't know, like Parker Posey in House of Yes kind of delivery, you know, where it feels like, oh, God, you know, step off of the stage. You know, you don't have to project to the back row kind of thing. So I usually like Parker Posey, but that one always stood out as like, stage play.
I am acting. But yeah, and yes, I have Gerald Grant, who came from a theatrical background and so cinematic of a performance. Just the winking and joviality that came through. All of that, without any of it feeling stilted.
Yeah, this one has made me want to go back now and dig out some of the old Lynn Lowry films as well. I really want to see Sugar Cookies now to see a little bit more of her. So.
And then also, I'm wanting to go back and look at some more of Radley's work, which I came into Score late. I first became aware of Radley through The Image, because it's an FM-themed, and people kept recommending that, and that's a great movie as well. But Score, for me, just kind of like even was better, because I love the comedic elements to it. I love the depiction of bisexuality, which is very hard to find, both in mainstream and foreign, because it's like it's either straight or you're gay, so... The bisexual element was very important for me in this.
Yeah, and we're pretty lucky right now. I mean, it sounds like a lot of Metzger stuff is coming out on DVD now and Blu-ray, and this stuff was just made for that. You know, it looks so
right. Gorgeous,
and to see it again in these, you know, really high-fidelity formats, it's really nice. Because I came to his work through The Image, and the first time I saw it was this really horrible VHS copy when it was called The Master and the Slave or something like that. It looked like it came off of a really bad 16mm print, and then seeing it on DVD a few years ago, I was like, wow, this doesn't even look like the same movie. You know, everything shifted up to a whole different... I mean, because Metzger stuff looks so beautiful, and seeing it in that horrible format, you know, couldn't tell.
The washed out colors. And...
Yeah. I mean, the print was like literally dirty. You could see the fuzz and stuff on the sides of the frame. And it's like, oh, man. And that kind of added to the decadence of the film a little bit, you know, and the it being kind of forbidden with it being, you know, this
right. Very
SM theme to it. But yeah, seeing it again on DVD, it was a whole new film and really made me appreciate it a lot more. Have you seen much more of his stuff? Can you recommend any more of his films?
Well, I think the one that everyone always mentions is the opening of Misty Beethoven. It's sort of a similar kind of thing where he takes the Pygmalion story and brings it to modern day, and then you have these scenarios that are unfolding against that story. So you have the structure of someone else's work sort of opening it up from that. But again, you know, it's just like the beautiful performances, just sort of the sumptuous cinematography. So I think that would be the next one I would look at. Barbara Broadcast is intriguing. It's a lot of fun. It's a little campier. And just for the opening scene, it's like so quintessential 70s New York. And it's this restaurant where the pretense is you can come in and order whatever sexual delicacy you want. And like the waiter will come over and rip his cock out, and you suck on his cock, and then he puts it back in, and you go on with your lunch. So if you haven't seen it, you should see that.
Yeah, I've heard good things about Private Afternoons of Pamela Mann as well. I'm going to have to check that one out, too.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm very curious about his film Mother, which was his Eva Peron film.
Right.
And, you know, I'm a huge fan of Evita, so I'm very curious to see what Metzger's version of that one is. I know no singing and no Mandy Patinkin or anything, but I'm curious to see that. So let's go ahead. We're going to take a little bit of a break here, and we will be back with more from Inside the Projection Booth.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at AdamandEve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOF at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out AdamandEve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at AdamandEve.com.
Welcome back to the Projection Booth. I'm going to play back an interview I did with Radley Metzger about Score. I know that you kept Claire Wilbur from the original folks, and of course, you know, you didn't keep Sylvester Stallone, but I was curious about the rest of the cast, why you didn't go with them, or how you picked the actors and actresses that you did, or actress, I should say, that you did for the film version.
I got Claire Wilbur, and I wanted the actor that played opposite her. In fact, I flew to Chicago to meet with him. Michael Byrne, I think his name was. And he was appearing in 1776, if you know that play. But his agent did not want him to leave the play for a four-week gig in wherever we were going to shoot it, which turned out to be a blessing because our four-week schedule turned into something like 6-8 weeks. If he had a firm commitment to go back to the play, he would not have been able to complete the film. So that worked out to our advantage. The young girl, I think, was just not appropriate because, you know, the play took place in a one-bedroom apartment in Queens, New York. It just, they just didn't seem appropriate to do a kind of a French Riviera play. That was true of Sylvester Stallone. He was very appropriate for the kind of, fabric that we were using. I really got blessed in terms of getting Lynn Lowry, because I've said on a number of occasions, I didn't think that it would have worked without her. If you didn't believe her, then I think the kind of the narrative would have collapsed. The young boy also was kind of Cal Culver, was a kind of a blessing in disguise, because he was just so appropriate and such a wonderful worker. I mean, actually, everybody in the cast, they were all really co-workers. It wasn't nobody was working for anybody. It was, the enthusiasm was good. Even though there were some differences, if you played the commentary, I think those facts were included. There were issues with the two girls, or I should say an issue. I don't think that, if I never said anything, Lynn never said anything, nobody would have known, because I really don't think it was on the screen, the fact that there was a kind of a tension with Claire, which was unfortunate. I was not as aware of it as I should have been. I don't know that I that I handled it as as well as I could have. But I had, you know, I was doing double duty on that film because I was not only, you know, responsible for putting it together and directing it, kind of producing it, but I was the operating cameraman when we got to Yugoslavia, and I met the director of photography, whom I had done a number of films with one German cameraman, and now I was working with someone else. We went over a lot of things, and I met his assistant, and I asked where the operating cameraman was, and he said, "We don't have operating cameramen," because they worked at that time mostly in the documentary field. I thought if we were going to have the lighting done, which was more complex than we used to working, because as it was a comedy, I want kind of a high-key feel to it. So that meant a lot of lights. I think we used every light in Yugoslavia at the time. It was very time-consuming setting everything. And if at that point we then had to start with the director of photography working out the moves with the camera, I think we would probably still be there trying to complete the film. So I said, well, I'll work out the moves with the actors, because I had a little phrase to myself. I always said that if the camera doesn't move, the audience will. I kind of carried a complex that its origin was a stage play, which means it's very dialogue dependent. So I said, we've got to keep the camera very, very fluid, which meant a lot of moves, even though a lot of them were subtle. They weren't, you know, long dolly shots. So we could work all of that out as he was doing the lighting. And when he was finished, we were finished. And that's how, you know, we got through it. And on the limited budget under which we were working, it turned out, you know, kind of the way it did. I thought the film, good or bad, I think the one thing it wasn't, as far as I remember, was static. It didn't look like you set up a camera and a lot of actors walked around and talked. There was a relationship between the actors and the movement. And that's why I did the operating. It was something that actually I enjoyed. I had a kind of feel for it. And I say that in the sense that I don't know anything else that I've ever had a kind of a natural feel for. Everything else I've done has been with great effort. And this seemed to come effortlessly. And also, if one is a control freak, it's wonderful. It plays right into that. You are in charge of everything on heaven on earth, the script, the actors, and now the camera movement. So it worked out well. One of the things that you give up is an awareness of a lot that's going on. I had heard Lynn had told me afterwards of some of the issues during the erotic scenes, which I hadn't been aware of, only because you become almost monomaniacal, the attention that gets, and you kind of not as aware of what's going on around you as you could be.
So I'm very curious what a normal, quote unquote, Yugoslavian production would be like, what kind of setup that they're more used to.
I think they're bigger productions. They might have had an operating camera, but basically, the man who lights it, I think, was the man who shot it. There were exceptions. We were shooting at the same time as probably the biggest film ever made in Yugoslavia. It was Tito was still in power at that time. They did a feature film on one of his exploits in World War II. It was quite phenomenal. I think it was the equivalent of Hannibal. And they got Richard Burton, who came with his wife, and they literally moved heaven on earth. And that was an enormous, enormous production. And around that time is when we were shooting. And I think that was certainly an exception. And I remember there was a prisoner of war camp movie at the time. And they certainly had full crews. But basically, average film, I believe, was shot, you know, without an operator. the year before Score, I had done a film, another film in former Yugoslavia, the one on the life of Eva Peron. We had the same crew, which also filtered down the following year to Score. It was the crew that did Fiddler on the Roof, because we had the same production manager. We worked together on a very complicated movie because we did a fictional version of Eva Peron's, and we had to make a fictional country, the fictional army and fictional uniforms, and a lot of extras. And that was a very complex film, but I got along very, very well with him. Well, we got along well together, and so the following year we did Score, which was for a small production, was, you know, there were certain complexities, but compared to the one I had done the year before, it was much simpler.
What kind of changes had to be made to the play for when Mr. Douglas adapted it for the screen, and what kind of input you had on that whole process as well?
Remarkably little. What attracted me to the play, those elements I had to keep, and Score, actually, almost for the first time, I've got really good reviews. I think a lot of the success was really a tribute to the basic play than to things I contributed. One of the things that I kind of was aware of, I try to shy away from, is when you do a play and you open it up, that is to say, it's a talky bunch of people hanging around. So every so often you stop the action and they all go out for some reason, and you create as many artificial situations where they can be in exterior situations. I tried very hard not to have that impression, but we did try to utilize the beauty of the town in which we were working. But as far as the essential narrative, don't recall making very, very many changes at all. We just kind of placed the scenes. One of the changes in the narrative is at the very end, they talk about in the play, he says, there's a new Fellini movie playing, let's go and see it. And since the director, Michael Powell, when I was just kind of trying to learn film on my own, there were no schools at that time. Michael Powell was really a very profound influence on me. I changed it to this Michael Powell movie playing. But I can't remember any dramatic changes. Jerry Douglas came on location. Part of our arrangement when we got the play was that he would come for a couple of weeks, which he did. We had to make a few cuts, and one of the cuts I was very sorry we made, which we actually shot, is where there's a sequence where they all play dress-up. In the play, it was covered where they actually go up and open a trunk, and they take out all the different clothes, and we actually shot that. But little length of whatever reason at the time, we didn't edit that footage, and it was never included.
Watching the film, I was always very surprised that Lynn Lowry's character didn't freak out when Elvira comes into the room dressed as a nun, because she just seems so uptight.
That actually was not in the play. That was my contribution. I had used that in my first or second movie. If you want an actress to look beautiful, dress her as a nun. It is the most flattering thing you can do to a woman, to bring out her features. Plus the fact, a certain iconoclastic aspect of it.
Yeah, well, I liked the use of the sailor and the cowboy kind of imagery for the guys as well.
Yeah, that was from the play.
Yeah, I've always had a very big pet peeve when it comes to stage plays on film where you can feel like they're stage plays, and I did not get that feeling from Score at all. I think a lot of it is the performances, too. Just so many strong performances and not that kind of over-theatrical, speaking-to-the-back-row kind of thing.
Let me say thank you, because we worked very hard on that. But they didn't really have to reach to the second balcony, because it was done in the round in the Martinique Theater, which I'm not even sure it still exists, down on 32nd Street, which was a very intimate theater. So it never was played, you know, to the back row. I have to say, they were perfectly cast, I thought. And since the two boys knew each other, and they were all friends of Jerry Douglas, there was a certain relaxation But it all comes back to a very cliche phrase, which I never really appreciated. If it's not on the page, it won't be on the stage. What I've thought a lot about why that worked so well in relation to other pictures I've seen and other pictures I've done. And I think what works is the clarity of the writing, which the actor, and of course me too, didn't have to do anything beyond that. It was all, I don't think I ever worked on anything that was so clear. And I think that was one of the attractions. For me, the project was a study in seduction. It was all very clearly done. That made everybody's job so much easier. And I'll always be very grateful to Jerry Douglas. Without his permission, I've gotten a lot of approbation based on his efforts. Nobody had to work on the interpreting the script. It was all just so clear.
The setting is a star in itself. You use that background and brought it into the foreground so well. Watching this film, I'm just like, oh my gosh, I want to go there. I want to see the Dalmatian coast now. This looks gorgeous.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, but that was actually something that my background I was able to bring to the project, because that's what I had done in previous films, was to exploit the background. I've said on many occasions, if I can't get this location, we can't do the movie. And I think that was true of a lot of things I did. And I think that maybe it's a kind of a manifestation of insecurity, I don't know. But I wanted something to kind of help me in my efforts. And I thought if I had a co-conspirator, another co-worker, namely a location or set, it would make my job easier and make the project more successful. We wanted the French Riviera, but it was prohibitively expensive. In fact, in France at that time, they had a different pay scale, the union, if you worked on the Riviera than if you, say, worked in Paris, because the cost of living was so much higher. If we could have gotten the real Riviera, we would have done it. That plus the fact that I had worked with the Yugoslavian crew the year before brought me down to the coast. And at that time, I said jokingly at the time that this was before they had invented orange, because everything in the country was either brown or green. Whatever in the film you see that is not brown or green, we brought from New York, the set decorations, the pillows, that sort of thing, to give it that kind of bright, happy look. But the Dalmatian coast and that little village in which we shot, everybody's gone on vacation where they realize that there's no way they could have taken a bad photograph. There are just certain places like that. I think instinctively I choose places like that. Hopefully people will not really appreciate the fact that it wasn't really me. It was almost anybody could take beautiful pictures there.
I know you talked on the commentary about how you were afraid that the pot in the pepper jar was going to be kind of anachronistic almost as soon as it was out there. But the one thing that stands out for me as being kind of something I don't see anymore is the use of the poppers. I don't even know how those are necessarily used. But I like how they both are broken at the same time. It just is such a nice moment in the film.
I think a lot of the effectiveness, I won't say success, but the effectiveness of the scenes was on the page. The second act ends when they break the poppers and say bingo, and that's the end of the act. And then we just took that and extended it. But the concept of the two seductions happening simultaneously was in the play. When the project was first re-released on VHS, I said, I don't think people are going to accept it. I said, it's just too old-fashioned. I said, it's being re-released at a time when smoking marijuana was not as prohibitive as it is now. And the fact that people put it in their pepper mill, I said, this is laughable. I said, nobody's going to take this seriously. I really underestimated people seeing it as an historical, it's done in a context. This is a period that we're talking about. We're not saying it's taking place today. When things are done yesterday, you accept the mores of yesterday. And I very happily I was wrong. As far as the poppers, I believe at that time it was fairly widely used, I think particularly among the gay community. In fact, there were theories at the time that that was a very significant element in the AIDS epidemic, in the fact that when you needed amyl nitrite, you were in heart failure, and it kept you going until medical authorities arrived. But when used abusively, as it certainly was at that period, it was a very profound insult to the immune system. And as I say, there was a lot of theories, and a lot of people took the position that it was a contributing factor to the AIDS epidemic. Matter of fact, for the openings and for publicity, we had popper holders. We bought 100 of them and had them embossed with the word SCORE, and we gave them out at openings. I don't know, last year sometime, I was passing a head shop in New York, and just for the joke, I went in and I said, do you have any popper holders? And they didn't know what I was talking about. And I thought, boy, I've really lived through an era. I meant to ask, because people have asked me in interviews about amyl nitrite, and I don't even know if it's still manufactured. I have never heard a reference to it in recent years. What was in the movie, when she opens up the poppers, it's a little metal container. And at that time, that little metal container had been obsolete many, many years. They had gone to cardboard containers. But we used that kind of as an homage to a bygone era.
So I'm very curious about the reception that the film got when it finally opened.
That's a story in itself. I decided to put everything I had into this film. We got the second best director of photography. We used every light in Yugoslavia. And we spent a lot of time in the editing. I was very fortunate to get a sound mixer who was one of the top people in New York. And it was luck, and the fact that I had known him I had started as an assistant editor at RKO Studios in New York. And the people I met there as an assistant editor, it became like a little mafia, in the sense that when the studio closed, everybody went somewhere else to work. But there was a kind of a bond between anybody who kind of worked there together. And one of them was this sound editor. In fact, the mixer, he had mixed one of the most complicated movies made in New York, The Taking of Pelham 123. And he had mixed that. And he was a consummate artist. I don't know that he was terribly comfortable doing this subject matter, but kind of as a favor, he mixed the film. As I say, we put everything into it. The picture opened in two theaters in New York, and as I say, I actually started to get some good reviews, and nobody showed up. Why? Because down the street, someone was playing an explicit film. Deep Throat had opened, I think, the year before, and now someone could go to their basement in New Jersey and on a weekend shoot a collection of explicit scenes. And that is what captured the audiences for erotic film literature. So the film, it didn't really do much business. And it was really very, from that point of view, very disappointing. It's been, in a sense, vindicated in recent years with DVD and Blu-ray, because internet-wise, I've had really some of the nicest things said about my work. But at the time, it just was kind of ignored, because those elements that I described and where we put our efforts really didn't have much interest for people. But that was just, sort of a cultural thing over which you really have no control.
Do you think that the gay context had any kind of reason to keep people away either, or was it just that there was hardcore now available?
The explicit stuff with the boys was never shown. We didn't use that because I think had we tried to show that, I don't think it was a question of audience rejection. I think we would have gone to jail. I was kind of surprised when late last year they had a kind of a big thing on Los Angeles with the film. It got reviewed, and I couldn't believe the fact that, and this was the explicit version, the critic said, by the way, if you're looking for real sex, you won't find it in this movie. Go somewhere else. And I thought, my God, we could have gone to jail showing this stuff. And now they say, this isn't really a sex film. Again, culturally, I think we've come full circle. I don't know that the homosexuality was the deterrent. I think that it was more the competition. If it were, I really don't recall that aspect of it.
Looking at your filmography, it seems that for a little bit, Radley Metzger went away and Henry Paris came out to play after Score. Was that a reaction to the hardcore being available now?
Yes. I can't say yes loud enough. We felt, because we had done, you know, things like Camille, we felt kind of above, you know, this kind of junky little explicit stuff. So we rose above it, and my partner and I decided that we weren't getting associated with that sort of thing. And about a year or two later, as we were about to be thrown into debtor's prison, because the company was doing very poorly, we said, okay, let's do it. We'll change our names, and we'll do a film. And we did it in, instead of 35mm Panavision, we did it in Super 16. I made up a little story, and we shot it in 6.5 days. Again, I think unfairly, I got a lot of attention, because the people doing explicit films at that time, well, Deep Throat was made by a hairdresser, and these people didn't, you know, really have the background. I had done, I think, at that time, like 13 or 14 feature films. You know, I don't say this snobbishly, because the second movie made by the fellow that did Deep Throat, I thought was more imaginative than my second movie. It wasn't a question that I was instinctively better than anybody else. It's just I had a little more experience. I only really knew one way to do films, and we did it on a smaller scale. And as a matter of fact, having worked in 35mm, it was a kind of a relief to shoot in Super 16, because the equipment was very light, and so moving was much simpler than it was in 35mm. This antedated Steadicams. And handheld was not that popular at the time. There's a lot of technical advantages in shooting in 16. And the Super 16 aspect meant that you had more information on the frame. So when you blew it up to 35mm, it wasn't that much of a blow-up mathematically, much different than, say, straight 16. And also the format lent itself to widescreen. So when we blew it up, it had a very strong quality. The reissuing of the Henry Paris films, it's been phenomenal. I've seen clips. It's incredible what the technology can do today. I know I saw a clip of Pamela Mann, and it was in the park, and I think I could count every blade of grass. The resolution was fabulous. At any rate, we did the film in 6.5 days, and all I did was what I had done, because I really didn't know any better. And the only difference was when the characters would kiss, and you'd normally go to something else, we extended it into the explicit area. So people said, gee, we never saw this before. Explicit films, you know, reached a new level. It sounded like almost like I was some kind of experimental genius, but it was really just doing the same thing that I had always done, and it had kind of the satiric humor that I had previously worked with. So it had enormous success. So I did another one. We got the rights to a book, Naked Came a Stranger, which had been as a book very successful, which is a story unto itself, which just about 10 days ago was released in Blu-ray. And after that, as far as exhibitors and nobody cared what I did, because the stuff was making a lot of money. I mean, at that point, I was walking on water. That resulted in Misty Beethoven. I think it'll be out in about 6 months. And then I did two more. That was the end of the Henry Paris career. I did a couple after that with some French people. I did the five pictures in 23 months, and I kind of reached a saturation point, so I kind of wanted to do the absolute opposite, and we got the rights to an old play, an original Dark House movie, you know, the reading of the will kind of thing, and we went to England and they did The Cat and the Canary, but that was kind of, that was a reaction to 23 months of uninterrupted eroticism.
Well, also in there, you did The Image as Radley Metzger as well, correct?
Yes, yes, but that that was a slightly different, that was a film, a book that was very important to a lot of people. I was very moved by that book. We were looking for something that met what I call the Audubon profile, a story with a very small cast. Score had five people in it, and I think we got to the irreducible minimum with The Image. There are only three people in it. And it was kind of a challenge to do something that, again, hadn't been done. I didn't recall a film that dealt with a kind of a master-slave relationship between people. I mean, there was no really explicit footage. I thought that was a challenge, and it gave me a chance to go to Paris. And we shot the film in the locations in which the book was placed. It was a chance to exploit the one's memories and impressions and stimulations of that city. Again, I think you would have to try very hard to make poor poor photographs in Paris.
So I'm curious, how did you come up with Henry Paris as your nom de fuck?
Well, Henry is my middle name. And my first films were done in Paris. And the film that really kind of elevated my reputation a little bit was Thérèse and Isabelle. And that was done in Paris. And I thought it just kind of went together. And I had worked with somebody, and that name was significant. So I kind of took it as for good luck. I didn't think anybody would ever know it. In fact, someone from Variety came and said, I'm going to talk about you at your Henry Paris. And I pleaded with them. I said, no, I'm trying to put food on the table, and you're going to confuse things, and you're going to stop me. He's terrible. Please don't. And he didn't. But the name Henry Paris became better known than my name was ever. But it's kind of become full circle, because I noticed on, I said there was a Naked Game the Stranger was just released a couple of weeks ago, and I saw the box and I noticed that they don't use Henry Paris anymore. So we've come full circle.
When was this potential outing by Variety?
Oh, it was right after Pamela Mann.
Okay, so it was pretty, your style was recognizable enough that folks...
I had done a bunch of films, and I kind of was sort of a brand. If you want to see an overproduced, elaborate, erotic, colorful movie, that's associated with my name. And I said, if you're going to see a small, explicit movie, I think audiences will be misled. And I think the worst thing you can do is mislead an audience. I think you have to be very clear when someone buys a ticket what they're going to see. And I really didn't want that confusion to take place. Plus the fact that maybe it's sentimental of me, maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I didn't want to go to jail. At the time, the law took a very dim view of people that made explicit films. You may have heard a lot about that Deep Throat case. So it was in that atmosphere that we changed our names. I mean, it wasn't based on shame or anything. It was just that you were doing things that were kind of quasi-legal. And some, you know, we live in a country of 50 states, so it's not as clear as, say, the censorship was, say, in Germany or in Sweden. We had 50 different venues, and things were really very confused. I think that's what, you know, that's what prompted everybody changing their names. Very imaginatively, if you look at the screen credits. I must say, the people that took on the Henry Paris films have done a remarkable job of investigation. These people could have found the Maltese Falcon, I think. They've really tracked people down, and I think some of them they've interviewed for the extras.
Welcome back to the Projection Booth, where I'm talking to CineKink Film Festival founder and programmer, Lisa Vandiver. Lisa, how many years has CineKink been going on now?
We're just entering our ninth season in a couple of weeks. We're founded in 2003, closing in on a decade pretty soon.
And what made you decide to start the festival?
Well, it was something I kind of backed into. I'd moved to New York. I was working in development, toiling in script coverage and trying to make things happen. And at the same time, I had fallen into an interest in S&M. So I discovered a local group, the Eulenspiegel Society. They wanted to do a film series. It was just sort of a way to do outreach to the public. And then that, of course, evolved into something more complicated, being a festival. And so I co-founded and helped produce an SM festival for them for a couple of years, and just really had found out how much I liked doing a festival and just the satisfaction of having something actually happen as opposed to these scripts that would be going back and forth on my desk for years. I really wanted to take that on and sort of expanded the interest beyond SM. So, and CineKink, for some reason, the name just popped into my head, and I looked up the domain. It was available, and that's kind of how CineKink was born. So I just kept going with it.
What kind of films have played there in the past? What are some of the titles that folks may know or they should look up?
It's been a real mix of things. We have the titles you might expect, like Secretary and Short Bus. Those have been programmed as we do like awards to what we consider mainstream films, which for us are mainstream, Secretary and Short Bus, just celebrating things that are out there for people to experience that have either a sex-positive, kink-friendly element to them. And then over the years, we've done things like In Vitro, which I just mentioned, the one that I compared to Radley's work, do a lot of shorts programs. Interesting, over the years, that's become such a favorite part of the festival, is these really strong works from people who are experimenting with either, you know, they're early filmmakers and they're experimenting with depicting sexuality, and so much comes through, you know, in terms of humor, great storytelling. That's actually my favorite part, is curating the shorts programs, because you kind of tell a story through the arc of that. We do a Bring It showcase where, you know, early on I experimented with showing more mainstream porn, but it's just really not suited for an audience kind of setting. So what we do is we call it Bring It, and we select a scene from each film. And so there are usually like five or six titles, and then the audience gets to vote on which one they like best.
Such as Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Balls.
Right, thank you. It did not win. Actually, we have our two-time title holder is Tristan Taramino, with Tristan Taramino's Rough Sex 1 and Tristan Taramino's Rough Sex 2, and she's coming back with Tristan Taramino's Rough Sex 3 this year. And then a new director who's doing something called a romance series out of New Sensations. This is actually kind of exciting for me. It's like we were talking about, that the story element is so compelling that you're drawn in and you're involved with the character, and then it cuts to some hot sex. But then the story keeps going. You know, the sex is maybe more extended than you might see in a Radley. That's going to be one of the clips, is Love is a Dangerous Game.
So when people send you stuff, or when you're out looking for it, I'm not sure what the mix is versus of what you actually see in the world versus what you get sent. But when you're doing that, what kind of stuff do you look for? What's the thing where you say, oh, this will be good for CineKink, or no, that's just a little not right for what I'm doing?
Well, it is a mix of, we have a call for entries, so we take submissions, and then other stuff is calling other festivals' programs to see what might work for us. And, you know, it's the same thing where a good film is a good film. So that's sort of the first criteria. But what's really important is sort of the sensibility of the film, whether it's sex positive. And for me, it's more the judgment towards sex in it. In fact, we tend to get some like horror kind of genre things that come in where people just think because there's sex and there's violence that that's SM. But, you know, it's very important that there be some kind of consensual element to it.
What is going to be shown in 2012?
Our opening film is Cabaret Desire from Erica Lust. And she's shown several shorts with us over the years, and they always win awards. And so she's come back with sort of this sumptuous series of vignettes, four different vignettes telling different stories of love and desire. We also have Eric Schaefer. He's, over the years, I started watching these in the 90s, a series of features charting the romantic adventures of his main character, Michael. So he's coming back with After Fall, Winter. That is, I think, the Wednesday night, the first night, 9 o'clock. Then we also have like a program of work celebrating the sense of kind of community that develops around kinky folk, you know, from the New York community. We also are showing the 25th celebration of Hinsel, so leather women. We have a documentary about asexuality that's going to be in the mix. And, you know, that kind of seemed like sex positivity for me, is being able to make a choice about how you want to.
The one film that's on this year's program that I really am curious about is, because I'm actually reading a book right now all about Bigfoot's appearances in film, and there's one called Sweet Prudence and the Erotic Adventures of Bigfoot. What is that one about?
Sweet Prudence is a zoologist, and she is tracking Bigfoot. There's been a sighting at, of course, a nudist colony, so she and her pals go out and seek him down, and then there's a competing zoologist who's trying to find and kill Bigfoot.
Very cool. And now, when I was there, the festival was down at Anthology Film Archives at 2nd and 2nd. Is it still there this year?
That's right. We're there Wednesday through Saturday, so all of our screenings are there. Then we do a kickoff party on the Tuesday, February 7th, and then we wrap everything up on Sunday with an awards ceremony, and then our ever popular afterglow party.
So that's February 7th through February 12th.
Correct.
And then folks who can't come out to New York can always see the touring program, which I think is really cool that you do this touring version of it. And what are some of the cities that you hit when you do the tour?
Oh, we hit Portland, my hometown. And then we also have been doing L.A., Las Vegas, San Francisco. We've done some years. We always hit Chicago, where the Leather Archives and Museum is. We're looking at bringing back Seattle, and I have some interest in, like, Tucson. So, yeah, I have interest all over, and basically what it takes is, like, an interested venue, somebody who can really embrace it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit of a hard sell. People are scared of it. So, but if someone really likes the idea and wants to run with it, like, we finally broke into Austin this year. And that was a fantastic success, near sold-out screening, and a lot of new CineKink converts. That was really great.
Well, I'm going to have to see if somebody in Detroit will pick up CineKink and run with it.
You have a kink-friendly theater there?
Maybe. We might have something opening up pretty soon down in Corktown.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break and play a clip from next week's show.
Who are you? Who sent you?
Nobody. I swear.
You're lying.
No, it's the truth, really.
Talk.
I don't know nothing. Nothing.
You asked for it.
No. Oh, no. No, that's too much. No, please. I can't resist. Help. No. Oh, no. Please. No. Help.
Thank you. That will be enough.
boy. Yeah, that was a clip from next week's show, Chicken Park. I'll be joined by Mike Sullivan as we talk about this clucking Italian film. That's all the time we have for this week. I encourage folks to check out Score, pick up copies via our sponsor, DiabolicDVD.com, and check out their incredible selection of other films by auteur Radley Metzger, also goes by the name Henry Paris. I want to thank our special guest, Lisa Vandiver, again for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun, and I appreciate the chance to sort of proselytize about Radley Metzger.
Be sure to check out CineKink.com, that's CineKink.com, and keep up with the festival. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Catch more of the Projection Booth at iTunes, Stitcher, or via the website projection-booth.com. And Lisa, I have one last question for you. Am I stoned yet?
Oh, not yet. I can't remember.
I don't want to be belligerent or anything, but if anybody saw me, I bet they'd say, there goes a cowboy from Montana.